Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince, they exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello everyone and welcome to this week's episode of the Proper Class Podcast. I'm Hannah Chiswick.
And I'm Laura Checkley.
And we are, of course, here to celebrate all things working class, because if we don't...
Who the bloody hell will? As always, we sit down with a working class hero to celebrate their life and achievements and discuss just how they got to where they are today. So on that note, who are we celebrating this week, Han?
Well, I'd go as far as to say this week's guest has got to be contender for our most inspiring and hilarious guest to date. Listener, if you're wondering what that sound of shattering glass is, that'll be this week's guest smashing through every glass ceiling there is. With her unique and infectious comedic style, she's challenging stereotypes at every turn.
Using her strict Islamic and African upbringing as the influence for her material, she is the UK's first black female Muslim Sudanese comedian. Recently, she was the first Sudanese woman to perform at the O2, a moment that must have felt incredible for her, but also so inspiring for other Sudanese and Muslim women.
A clinical pharmacist by day and a stand-up comedian by night, there is no doubt this woman is making huge waves in the comedy world. But I have a feeling we've only seen the start of what she's going to achieve.
Citing her dad as her comedy hero, our guest is a leading advocate for Sudanese women. Her visibility is inspiring not just to Sudanese women, but to women all over the world whose voices are often left unheard. And to be honest, I think it would be fair to say this woman is literally changing the world one laugh at a time.
Popping up at the top comedy venues all over the UK, recently appearing on CBBC, rocking up to the O2, hosting her own weekly online series, Would You Rather, and co-hosting her own podcast alongside her American rapper husband, this week's guest has her fingers in so many pies, I don't even know how she's had time to be here.
So listeners, please give a huge Proper Class Podcast welcome to the hijab-wearing, no-punch-holding, total-ass-kicking legend that is Ola Labib! Woo! Welcome!
Hello. Oh, that's such a nice warm welcome.
Was it? It wasn't too cringy.
I try not to listen, to be honest.
You took your earphones out then, didn't you, when we were doing that, and you just popped them back in.
I just started procrastinating, thinking about different things like washing the dishes.
Exciting, glamorous things like that, yeah.
Why do you think we do that? Because do you think it's like an exclusive thing to a performer, or do you think it's like a working class thing, or do you just think it's like people, or is it a British thing? I don't know.
I think it being a working class thing plays a massive role, because like we've all been on the end of like, oh my God, that person, oh, have you seen his car? Oh my God, he's this. Oh my God, he's been on this. So you've been on that side. So to have someone do that to you, it's just like, I've got this really bad habit, and I think I've done it in most gigs when people come to see me, I don't like going to the green room. So if someone's like, oh, Ola, I think you're great. Like from the, oh, I've got this, I don't think it's a bad habit, but I'd go into the audience. I'd be like, oh, what's your name? I was like, oh, that's really, oh, thank you. Oh, and what do you do? So I start like showing more interest in them.
Yeah.
So it kind of takes away from me a little bit. So that's something like I'm notorious for doing.
Yeah, yeah. I've been trying to get better at it, but it is like, oh, no. You're, how are you? Oh, I like your shirt. Where's that from? You know, like, yeah, totally. Yeah,
yeah,
totally.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So we start each week asking our guests to take us back to a place and time that has some meaning to them, somewhere that has a connection to their working class roots. So, Ola, if you could take us anywhere today, where would that be?
So I'd take you to a place called Queen Elizabeth Country Park. And that's like a little forest area just on the outskirts of Portsmouth. And
sounds posh.
Oh, it's not. It's free to get in.
Great start. And,
yeah. But it was really nice because Mum and Dad actually used to always take us there when people would be doing specific things that we couldn't do. So, for example, like in year five, everybody goes to a place called Little Canada. It's like you go for 3 days to camp and do different activities or whatever, or you go to the Brecon Beacons with the school trips. But we could never go because there was like three of us. So it'd be really expensive to take us all. So Dad used to always take us to Queen Elizabeth Country Park, and we'd like, you know, he'd like sort out events and like, you know, we'd just do crazy stuff, and he'd be like, oh, why do you want to go to Little Canada? And I'm like, there's a roller coaster at Little Canada, Dad. And he'd grab me and he'd like swing me round. He's like, why do you need a roller coaster? You got one right here.
I love that.
Oh. But yeah, that's just somewhere that we've always, that was always our kind of go-to. That was always our go-to place. And yeah, I guess it just has, it takes us back. 3 years ago for Eid, I actually organised that we did like a mini family sports day there. So we all went back because, you know, everybody lives in different places now.
Oh, wow.
So it's like kind of our, like, our safe zone, if you like.
Yeah. You did a sports day there.
Yeah, I did a sports day. It was quite bizarre because Dad's waddling, Mum's not getting the games. My 16-year-old brother wants to win everything. So it was obviously a completely different vibe to what it was like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah.
And was that the first time you've been back in a while, or do you tend to go back there a lot?
I think it was the first, like, I go back every now and then, but for all of us collectively as a family to have gone together, it's been like since we all lived in the same house, so like 15 years ago.
It's so important, those places, you know, that are like free. I mean, now more so than ever, that families that, you know, haven't got any money can take them somewhere, you know, because often when you are working class, you're living in like small houses, people are sharing rooms. It's just a nightmare, isn't it? And what did that park have in it? Like, did it have like a park, or was it just like a big open field, or what?
Yeah, it did have a park, you know, like just slides, swings, this, that. And they also have like barbecue things. So you can, we used to buy like loads of tin foil because you don't know what nitty stuff people have been cooking on.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, and we'd like just bring food. And it is nice. I can't lie and say we didn't have that feeling of missing out. Like when we used to go to school and everybody would be like, oh my God, we did this, we did that. Naturally, as kids inside, you'd be like, oh, well, I did this and I did that and I had lots of fun. And you'd big up what you did. And obviously, like, you know, thank God for everything. I'm not complaining. But you do have that feeling of missing out. But I think...
But you don't know you're missing out until someone says, oh, we went on holiday to Florida. And you're like, wow, what's that? How did you do that? Like,
Yeah. But we saw how hard my parents, like, I guess, like, maybe girls are a little bit different to boys in our family. But I saw how hard my parents worked. So I never felt like, oh my God, I'm missing out on this, I'm missing out on that. Like I did used to get pissed because my older brother, I love you, Muhammad, but he was fucking spoiled as anything. So he'd really dig his heels in and be like, I really want to do this, I really want to do this. And like my dad used to like pick up extra shifts and stuff just so that he could go. But I'd never have the heart to do that. I would never, like, I saw how hard my mum and dad worked. But my older brother always had the mentality of, well, when I grow up and I work hard, I'll give it all back to them.
Right.
That's the mentality he had.
What was your school environment like? I mean, were you in a school that was like people in a similar sort of socioeconomic background to you, or were there more affluent people in the school? Or
so because of our situation growing up, I went to multiple schools in the area. So I went to 4 or 5 different primary schools.
Oh, wow.
So the first school we went to be honest, like, that was at an age where we weren't going to lots of school trips, but it was a very, even until now, it's one of the worst areas in the in Hampshire, where I used to live. But then we went to this Church of England school called St. Jude's, which was like literally the bougiest school. But it wasn't a private school, but it was like in a good area. Right. But we lived like in a at that time we lived in a council estate. But my dad really applied strongly, really put up a case so that me particularly can get into that school. Because he's, you know, in our community, we're usually more worried about the girls than the boys in certain environments.
Mm.
So my mum used to take a bus to take me to that school, go to work, and my dad then used to pick me up. So it was quite far from where I lived, but it was so important for them to send me to a good school. But then when I got into year five, we moved to a different area that was a lot better than where we lived. So then in year five and six, I went to a not great school, but like a lot better than two of the original schools I went to.
What's it like moving about so much? It's so hard being a kid anyway, and then moving about and you're having to start over each time. How do you feel like that's had any sort of lasting effect as a grown up? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I found it really difficult because I found it really difficult to make friends. Like Portsmouth was predominantly white when I was growing up. It was only up to the early 2000s that you started to see like an influx of people of colour.
Mm.
And predominantly it was people from the Asian community that lived in Portsmouth. Those are of colour, which is completely different to our community.
Of course, yeah.
So when I went to school, I used to be like I literally was the only like African girl in my school. Like, I know I joke about it, but that's legitimately the truth.
Yeah.
And so two of the schools, I was really happy when I moved, but there was one school I went to, and that was, funnily enough, St. Jude's, the bougie school. The first year was the worst year of my life. But then when I got to the second year, there were two people that started the school and I instantly like grappled hold of them before anybody else did.
Yeah.
And we became friends. And then within 3 months, my parents told us we've got to move again.
So
that was really difficult for me because I was always worried that what if I struggled at the next school? But again, when I got to year six, obviously there's always like dickheads everywhere you go, but I did have like two really good friends that I ended up going to secondary school with as well, but yeah, it was really difficult. Like I understood, like I felt they've always said that I was very grown for my age, but I got my parents' situations. I see my mum working 3 a.m. until like 3 p.m. in factories 12 hours straight. I'm never going to argue with her and be like, oh, it's not fair. Like, I see how tired she is. Even like now, I don't know why I'm getting so emotional, but like, I'd see like the varicose. She suffered from really bad varicose veins. She was heavily pregnant. She almost went into labor at work. Like, my mum worked so, so hard. And I'd see how hard she worked. And same as my dad, I would never argue. I would never be in a place to argue with them.
Did you feel a huge responsibility then to do well? I mean, obviously you're super clever because you've followed a scientific kind of path, and like, did you feel like a pressure to succeed at school?
Oh, 100%. And I think a lot of immigrant
Yeah.
I think a lot of immigrant kids are like that. Yeah, and I don't think it's a surprise that we tend to get top in the school, and people think it's like a showing off thing, but it's not at all. Like, people will never understand what our parents went through back home where they are. And the thing is, it's not just a response. People think it's just a responsibility for our mum and dads. No, it's a responsibility for our parents here. Mm-hmm. And we have tons of family back home that 100% depend on diaspora to provide for them. So the pressure to do well is always like optimum, even in comedy. Like, I've only been going like 4 years. And I think sometimes I drive my manager a bit mad, and she's like, Ola, you know, maybe next year you can do it. I'm like, no, I want to do it now. Like, I'm ready to do it now. I'll put in the work. I'll do whatever it takes. But Ola, you need like 20 minutes in 2 weeks. No, I'll do it. I was like, I'll sit down and I'll do it. Like, trust me, I'll do it. So it's always this kind of like feeling that not only do I want to work hard, but I want to achieve everything now so that you progress quicker, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And is there a want to want to look after them a bit as well and let them ease off a bit and go, look, I've got you now, I can help. And because I know it's just as a working class, you know, girl, I've always felt that with my parents, like it's so nice to be able to give them something back a bit. You know, I got them dinner at the weekend and it was such a big deal. They're like, no, I was like, I want to get your dinner. I'm 42. Let me get you some bloody dinner. I've been working hard. And it's, yeah, I know I have that massive feeling like I just want to help all, you know, all my family because they all work so hard. Do you have that sort of like, I want to, does that drive it as well?
Oh, 100%. Like, as a pharmacist, I locumed the last three, four years because the money was better. So I did the same thing of moving around all over the country doing temporary contracts. And that was to help out with my parents. Like, at the moment, I'm renting this place, but I got a mortgage in 2018.
But my parents
are living in the house just so that they don't have to worry about rent and they don't have to worry about this and don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, that's great.
I've moved down, like, do you know what? I wouldn't be fucking surprised if my dad comes walking in through the door now. It's so annoying. I moved in at the end of my parents' road. So he only lives like 7-8 houses down, just so that if they need anything, that I'm close by. I thought it would be to my advantage. Sorry, Dad, it is. I do love you, but for God's sake, can you call me before you come over, please?
My dad does that. He's got keys to my sister's flat, and they're around the corner. And she like gets home from work, and he's just there with a cup of tea. And she's like, "I've got shit to do. Can you get out, please?" Like, my mum's like, "You can't just let yourself in all the time."
4 months to build up the courage to tell my dad to give me the house to my the key to my house.
So obviously your dad's been like a big influence. You talk loads about your dad and like say that he's your comedy hero. And he sounds like, from what you were saying earlier, like a bit of a sort of like made your childhood kind of magical and fun and strict at the same time. So was there like, tell me a bit about that kind of combination of upbringing.
I think it's stupid, but I think it's because I've been raised in this country and we live like a completely different life to people that live back home. But unfortunately, like in communities like us, we don't just think about ourselves. They think about what everybody else is saying. So say, for example, I wanted to go on holiday. And that's like, for a girl to travel on her own, it's dangerous. It's like completely frowned upon. She has to go with either her father, her brother, or when she gets married, her husband, just because. But my dad like sees how hard I worked and he's like, oh, I do want you to go, but what would people say kind of thing. So he was just as much as I was like fighting to do what I wanted to do. He was fighting to let me do what I wanted to do. But he obviously like, for I think absolutely twatty reasons, had to think about what everybody else thought as well. So, you know, he was strict about loads of stuff. It was really annoying because like they were really strict with me, but they weren't as strict with my brothers. And I hated that because I felt like I took a lot of the responsibilities at home, in the sense of like if anything needed to be done, if someone had to stay with my to babysit my siblings, even though I didn't even live in Portsmouth at the time, I was working away, I would be their first port of call. Yet if I wanted to do something, they'd be like, oh, no, you can't, because as a woman, you know, it's not right. But my brothers would be off gallivanting, doing whatever the hell they wanted kind of thing. So that used to always stress me out.
Sure. So you're in your secondary school. Your two mates have come with you. Did you stay at that secondary school, by the way? No. Oh, my God. How many secondary schools did you have?
Oh, only two.
Okay, an improvement on the primary school years. So do you think moving about a lot made you sort of lean into comedy a lot? Was that a quick way of making friends, or has comedy developed later for you?
I think you always have the feeling, well, I always had the feeling that I had to win people over. Because people, you know, it's natural in human instincts to judge someone just by looking at them kind of thing. And I felt that I tried to overcompensate by like being over nice or over funny, that they like me regardless of how I look kind of thing. So I think that definitely played a big role. And then when I got to like college, two of my friends were really, 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 really beautiful girls. And they went to uni with me as well. Really pretty girls. And my older brother, absolute dickhead, was like, you know, he was like, you do know there's a golden rule with ugly girls. Always befriend girls uglier than you. So I was like, so that obviously upset me. I was like, what the hell are you trying to say? And he was like, friend one is the sexy one. Friend two is the beautiful one. And you, and at that point, I did look really traumatized. And he went, look, you're really funny. So he went, just hold on to that.
Wow.
Oh my God. Wow. You're right. He is a dickhead.
He is a dickhead. And the thing is, he got really upset because I was on Dave's Black History Month. They did like a Black History Month, yeah, where they did interview, and I spoke about that, and I said, and I'm laughing. It's like, I don't give a shit. I'm married now. Like, I don't care what he thinks.
Yeah, yeah.
I'd be borderline inbreeding if he praised me on how beautiful I was. But like, I was talking about it, and he was like, did I say that? And I'm like, yeah, you did. And he was like, oh yeah, I did. God, I?
Siblings are so mean, aren't they?
They are. But he, according to him, he was like, well, if I didn't say that, he went, you wouldn't be doing the career you're doing today.
Oh, sure. So it's all thanks so it's to all me. Thanks.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's all thanks to him calling me ugly.
So how were like the university years? Were your parents, how did they feel about you going away? Were they anxious about it? And
I didn't go away. They didn't let me go away. I had to study at Portsmouth University.
Right.
And so you lived at home?
Yeah.
And did you manage to kind of, how was that? Did you feel like the gap widened between the experience you and your mates were having?
Yeah, oh, big time. Like, especially in first and second year, they loosened up a bit in third year because I had like a massive like crisis where I was like, there is no difference between me today as a third year or fourth year university student. My course was 4 years. And me being in year three or four, I said, I'm treated the same. I was like, how are you giving me curfews? They used to give me like curfews of 8 o'clock. I'm like, dad, students wake up at 8 o'clock.
Oh, bless.
And he'll be like, oh, why don't you just organise with your friends that, you know, like wake up. I was like, dad, I'm not going to start telling them their fucking sleep schedules just to work around myself.
Yeah.
So then like I really threw a fit and I got really upset. And I was like, what have I ever done to deserve this? I've always tried to be the best daughter. I've never asked for much, blah, blah, blah. I just want like a little bit of freedom, just like a little bit of like breathing space, blah, blah, blah. So he started to loosen up at the end of uni, which made no sense because they were the most demanding years. So I wasn't doing anything anyway.
Yeah, he timed it right.
He timed it perfectly. Around my dissertation, he was like, right, do whatever you want. And I was like, yeah, there's nothing much I can do now. But after my dissertation, he did loosen up and my final year was really, really good. And then work started, and that you don't have time to do anything when you start working.
So I'm really interested to know, like, when the comedy started and what, like, made you first... What did you do? Like, what was the first time you stood up and did some comedy? Like, what was the journey to that moment?
So I didn't want to do pharmacy. Sorry, pharmacy, general, whatever. But I didn't want to do pharmacy. And in our community, we always push, like, if you become a doctor, it's like the wow, wow, wee wow. So my older brother's a doctor and I applied for medicine, but I didn't get in and I didn't want to take another year and risk not getting in the second time round. So I just went for pharmacy, as to be honest, a lot of pharmacists do who want to do medicine but don't get in. But anyways, that's another topic for another day. Sorry, pharmacists, no offense, but you know it's true. But yeah, I did pharmacy and then I went into clinical pharmacy, so like hospital-based pharmacy. And then I was just progressing. I did another master degree, then I specialized. And then I just got to a point where I was just like, even though I'm progressing, it wasn't making me happy. It really wasn't making me happy. I didn't feel that there was a void that wasn't being filled. And it just really started to get me down. And I've always loved comedy. I always loved watching comedy. I love public speaking. Like I loved all that stuff. So I was just like, why not try stand-up comedy? So when I was working in Manchester, I was doing a temporary contract, which turned to 3 years. I went to an open mic night.
Amazing. That's so brave.
Yeah. There was only 2 audience members.
But you must have known to go and do that. You must have known at some point, like people must have said to you, obviously your brother said you were funny, but like you must have had mates, people at work that laughed at you, because that's how it starts, right? That's the bug. People make you laugh, girl. That felt good.
Oh yeah. Oh, like when I worked at Bournemouth Hospital, they used to call me the hospital jester, and which is really nice. Like I used to love that. Patients used to be like, "Oh, is that pharmacist coming to my ward today? Oh, is it going to be that pharmacist that's coming?" And that's such a nice feeling that you get asked for. So at the moment, I work for St. Mary's as a medicines advice at home team pharmacist, where I do home visits to patients to ensure that they're taking their medication correctly, blah, 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 boring, boring, boring. But it's really nice when another pharmacist makes an appointment and the patient was like, "Oh, can I have her again, please?"
Oh, my God. That's
so
yeah.
Nice. That makes me really happy. So, yeah, I think it really stems from that kind of feeling of approval, like wanting, I'm like desperate for people. And that sounds so fucking pathetic. You're pathetic, Ola. Absolutely pathetic. But I like that need for people to like me. And I feel like through humor, it's the easiest way for people to kind of like approve of you, if you like.
I'm sure if we were honest, we'd all say we have that.
But any comedian, any actor, we've all got that. And I think anyone's lying if they say then it doesn't start like that, at least, at the very least.
It's an interesting thing, though, isn't it? Because we've had quite a few comedians on as guests, and nearly all of them would say that they are not the funniest person in their family. Like I'm funny, but I come from a like, and you speak about your dad a bit like that, about your dad just being...
Oh, my dad's so funny. But all my family, not all my family, actually. My mum's unintentionally funny. She's funny because she's so annoying, it makes us laugh. But we have very different senses. Like, my older brother, he's really funny, but he's funny because he's so harsh and so dry. It's so funny. Like, oh, I don't know, my husband, but like the other day, my brother just turned 16 and my other brother was like 35, and there was like a load of us, and he was like, "Oh, it's not even funny." He was like, "So are you gonna start using your pecker?"
Oh God, what did he do? The little brother, I mean.
He's obviously traumatized, yeah. Because he's like,
"What's a pecker?"
Like, what the
yeah. I love that he used pecker as well. It's so silly.
He's just so dumb. He's just an idiot. So he's funny in that sense. And then my dad's funny because my dad's just hilarious. But yeah, we all have very different styles of humor. Like, they used to find me funny because I've got a very short temper. And I think it is because of like everything that was happening in school. But they wanted to put me through anger management when I was like in year five. I was like, I just burst. And when I used to go off on rants, even now, I think that's when my siblings find it the funniest.
Yeah.
Like when I just lose it because I just start saying stuff and I'm just like, ah! They find it. And that's why I did, I started to do, not a podcast, like a blog called Excuse Me While I Rant. And if something made me angry, just pick up my phone and record it. But then I didn't want therapists DMing me. So I was like, you know what, let's leave that for another time. Yeah, yeah.
Hi, Ola, I could help.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
So you did your 5 minutes. Talk us through quickly what then your journey to finding an agent and it becoming a real thing, a reality. Like, how did that journey work?
So where I did the open mic, the person there asked me to come back again. And he's probably sick of me shouting him out all the time. He's a guy called Jason Cook, who runs the Apple and Ape in Manchester. Yeah. And he's the kindest man. And I'm just so blessed that that was the first place I performed, because he'd ask for me back to perform again and recommend me to other people that had like small gigs and stuff. So it just went by just doing loads of open mics, like obviously free open mics within Manchester. And yeah, you just keep going. And sometimes you're lucky and there's a promoter from somewhere else that will see you or hear about you and ask you to come and do a trial at the. So within a year, I've probably gigged most of Manchester, Liverpool, Leeds areas, like that kind. Is it Northwest? I'm so dumb at geography.
Oh God, don't ask like me. The, yeah, I dropped geography.
Oh yeah, me too. I have absolutely no idea.
I can't even find my way to like audition venues that I've been a million times on my phone. I still cannot follow a map. I can't do it.
True story.
So terrible. They're like, you've been there before like 30 times. Yeah, I'm down the wrong road. I don't know. Like, so bad. And so all of that's happening. Did you share in that first year where it all started kicking off, did you share that with your family?
No.
No. How was that?
I just think, like, like traditional families, they call it the immigrant complex, where they think that, you know, working a 9-to-5 and progressing and working for somebody else is the like
dream
goal. Yeah.
But I was just like, this is like I'm open about. My mom's not happy with it. She found out because I did the O2 and it went viral, and because they put me as a Sudanese comedian. So obviously it hit Sudanese WhatsApp. Sudanese right. WhatsApp is literally the most toxic, most like you can literally fart and you know that by the end of the day, the whole of the Sudanese population around the world will know that Ola Libib farted. So they it went viral. So obviously she saw it and she was just like, you know, she's, I don't get what, like, okay, I get it. I get there's certain things I have to restrict and, you know, I'm trying to restrict saying certain things that maybe I shouldn't, you know, not swear, you know, try and keep it as clean as possible. But I was like, mum, like, I was like, I've obeyed your every command growing up, like literally your every command, I've obeyed it growing up. I said, this is the one thing that makes me happy and I'm really sorry, I love you, but I'm gonna do it regardless.
And have your parents been to any of your gigs live? Have they come and watched you?
Barbara's been to one. That was a charity one where we were raising money for Sudan. And he was really happy because the BBC were there, like, doing interviews and stuff and interviewing me. And I could see, like, he was, like, proud and stuff. But I still tend to, like, not... He knows what I do, but we don't really talk about it. We don't really talk about it, to be honest.
Do you think that'll get easier over time, like with everything?
Money makes anybody smile.
so true.
So as soon as I get that one big hit and I put that check on their table, I think they'll be okay.
It's gonna
happen. That's what a lot of the fear is to do with. And obviously you've got like that whole immigrant thing and a different like cultural background, religious background, but even to all our guests that we speak to that working class, I just think there's a fear in working class families that like, why would you give up something secure and a good job for something that is, let's be honest, about as riskier? You know, it's just people don't see it as like an actual career until you say, look at this check that someone has given me.
Or you're on the telly and all of that. Yeah, yeah.
You've literally hit the nail on the head. It's the concept of security. You have a 9-to-5 job, senior pharmacist. Why would you let that go? And they always say people back home would kill for a position like you. And I'm like, well, yeah, but it's so subjective to where you are and who you are.
Of course.
I would happily give that to someone, one of my family members back home.
Yeah.
If I could, and I'd get on doing what I'm doing, and then they could have the responsibility of dealing with like the fact, I would love that. But I still do pharmacy sometimes just so that I can stay on the register. So I do the odd shifts here and there just so that I don't intend to come off the register, because you just don't know what will happen, who will cancel you. You just don't know. So you have to have like a form of stability or security, if you like.
Yeah. So, and you've got that. I mean, if you look at, I always think of somebody like Dr. Range, and like you think about the level of like success that he's got now, you know, and he's on Strictly and he's done this and he's done that, but he's still in A&E. Like he does the odd A&E shift, and he like, I was actually speaking to him, funnily enough, we were doing some training together, and he was saying a similar thing. He was like, oh, you know, it's very hard to let go of that thing that you've worked so hard at, that's the big pride of your family.
Yeah.
And also, you know, it's, you speak about bits of your job like you love them, like going into people's homes and making them feel, I mean, maybe not so much, here's your medication, but the bit that's social, not so much, but the bit that's social and like, you know, where you interact actually with people and that part of it.
Oh yeah, 100%, 100%. There is nothing more rewarding than knowing that you've made a difference to someone's life, like literally their life, like going to someone who's in severe pain and recommending a pain pathway that will help them. Or like I did oncology and I worked with palliative patients. That was the hardest thing I ever had to do. And do you know what, like whilst doing comedy, there were times where I would deal with these patients and have gigs after, and I would say, like, obviously I'd bomb quite a lot of the time, but I had to form a boundary. I can't go from talking to someone saying, you know, like, okay, we're giving you these injections to ease your pain, will they treat it? No, they won't. Like it's so difficult having to deal with palliative patients and going to try and make people laugh. It's literally the hardest thing. But at the same time, it's rewarding. So even if later on I bomb at that comedy gig, I know that I've made someone at that moment feel better. So maybe I made the audience feel shit, but at least somebody today, you know, like there was some form of positivity, if you like. It's really hard. It's really hard to explain. It's really
not at all. You explain it brilliantly. Yeah.
And do you I mean, obviously, it's going to come a point, I mean, it's already happening for you, where you probably might not have much time for it, because no doubt, I mean, I'm watching your rise, like it's so incredible to watch, and I think you're going to be huge. I think you're already on your way to. I do. I think you're so brilliant, funny, and inspiring, and you know, it's all that. If you can't see it, you can't be it. And I just think it's so wonderful for youngsters to watch you and see you doing it and doing it brilliantly. But there's going to come a point where you have to kind of, I suppose, leave that behind. Do you think you're going to be able to do that, or are you going to try as much to dip back into?
I think in a month, or let's say in 3 months, I'll do 2 or 3 shifts max.
Right.
So I'm not doing a lot of it, but then there'll be times where there's like a kind of a quiet period where I'll do writing, but I'm like, you know what? Oh, why not just go in and help? Because I know my department at the moment are understaffed anyways, and they love having me back, and I love seeing them. They're a brilliant team.
It's hard to stop working, isn't it? As a working class person, I've discussed this all the time on this podcast. I taught alongside acting and doing comedy right up till sort of a couple of years ago, really. I was too scared to jump off, and I'd dip my feet in, and And I'd keep going back to this, the drama school that I used to teach at all the time, just because I was so frightened of it all going away. And I'm so frightened of the money running out and all of that.
I was just about to say, you're just so, aren't you just so used to knowing that at the end of the month, I'm going to get X amount?
Yeah.
And it's just that mental thing that at least I know I'm getting X amount. And for the longest time, but it literally wore me down to nothing. Where I would work 4 days and like if I have a gig in London, because I live in Portsmouth, I've probably said that like 50 million times. But I'd
ask Sorry, where do you live again?
Okay. But yeah, I'd like leave early just so that I can make it. And it just got too exhausting. I just couldn't. But I'm not gonna lie. That feeling of knowing at the end of the month, at least I knew what I was getting. That is something that...
It's hard to walk away from, isn't it? Yeah.
And so were you already married by the time you started doing comedy? Or what came first, comedy or marriage?
So I got married first. And obviously I married him because I love him. But also I married him that because when I was getting more and more gigs, I was like, let's get married straight away. Because if I got more and more gigs, then I don't have to answer to my parents anymore.
Amazing.
And he's obviously like really, because he's doing all his own extraordinary kind of like boundary breaking stuff himself. So is he really supportive of your comedy?
No, he's really, really supportive. He's always been supportive. He gets it. You know, he's had similar experiences to me, but he's very much, and I'm the same. He's very much just stay true to yourself. Don't ever do anything you don't want to do. Don't ever agree to something that you think is going to make you look bad. Because I've said this a million times to anyone that will listen, I'm not just representing myself. I'm representing a Sudanese community.
Yeah.
I'm representing women and I'm representing Muslim women. So I'm under so much pressure. If I mess up anything or give a false representation of anything, it will fall on me so bad.
Yeah,
that's a huge responsibility.
It is.
And also, I think I feel really excited for you in like, what a huge platform you're going to, that you already have, but you're going to continue to have to just like make such a massive difference. And I'm sure like for all the kind of Sudanese WhatsApp will be like, just so like, you know, it's going to be such an amazing positive way for you to kind of represent everyone. It's an amazing thing.
Exhausting, but it's amazing.
It's exhausting. But you know, like I said it the other day on David, I didn't even know that they were going to put it in the edits, but you don't really know what impact you make until you hear it. A parent actually messaged me, this is months and months ago, saying we were watching CBBC and we saw you on one of the programs that I was on, and my daughter was struggling because she started wearing a hijab, but people used to say lots of stuff, so she was like, she wanted to take it off because she was like, she didn't feel comfortable. Yeah, basically he was just like, when he saw you on TV and like how like warm you are and how you were making people laugh or whatever, he said that you're the reason that she didn't take it off, and it gave her the feeling of like, well, if someone... So it's all to do with representation.
Of course.
If that's what I'm doing, God, honestly, that one comment made me work 10 million times harder. If that's the impact that I'm having on younger girls, honestly, like it is the best feeling.
So what's next for you? What excite, if you can talk about it, what's next?
So like I've been doing a lot of writing, so I'm hoping, fingers crossed, some things get made. So I've got a script that's been optioned, and there's also a script that I submitted to UK TV in a competition, and I made it to the next round.
Yeah, well done, amazing.
I'm just seeing what I can do with writing, because there's not many characters that look like me on TV at all.
No.
So it
yet.
Would be
not yet.
Yes, exactly. Beautifully said. Yes. So I'm hoping I turn that yet to now.
Exactly. And hurry up as well.
So that's what I'm hoping for. I'm performing everywhere. I've got some TV appearances coming up, which is really exciting. Definitely be making a twat of myself, but yeah, it's all right.
Yeah, great. That's all right.
What else? Oh, I don't even know. But yeah, mostly just writing for people as well, not just for myself, for TV shows as well. And performing. I'm working towards my first hour. So I'm just going to see what I'm going to do with that.
Yes.
It's, I mean, everything about your story and the work that you're doing and your comedy as well is like so inspiring. But even from what you were saying before, like, you know, being a Muslim girl and being in a Church of England school, yes, right up to now, you must constantly, obviously, find yourself in spaces where you are the only person who looks and represents like you. It can't all have been smooth sailing. Like, how much shit are you still having to deal with now?
Loads. In comedy, like, comedy's great, but in a lot of the spaces, even as a woman, you find you're the only bloody woman.
Yeah, even just as a woman. Yeah.
Exactly. And I don't you just hate that feeling where they're like, oh, we've got a lineup, but we've got one space for a woman, and it's just like, what do you mean you've got space for a woman? It shouldn't be because do you know what I mean?
It's the worst, yeah.
We want you as an actress, we want you as a comedian because you're good, not because you want to fill diversity quotas. And I get a lot of people that are like, oh, you're so lucky you tick loads of diversity boxes. And they make you feel like that's the only reason why you're getting anywhere. Yeah. And it's like, maybe it's because you're not funny and we don't want to hear you talking about your dick for the next 3 hours.
I think that as well with like diversity. I mean, obviously I'm a like white woman like piping up about it, but I work with a lot of like young global majority actors and they feel that really strongly. They say a lot of the time, like, oh, I'm worried that people think I'm just getting in the room for this and I'm only getting in the room for that. And my feeling about that, and even as a working class woman, like, I work in the theatre and it's still like there's none of us knocking about. And I always say, do you know what it is? It's that you weren't getting in the room before and you should have been. It's not that you're getting in the room now and you're lucky. It's just disgusting that you weren't getting in the room before. So take it. It's things that's been stolen from you and opportunities you weren't given, not ones that you're being gifted now.
Absolutely.
So get in there and stick your elbows out and help everyone else in. Like,
the thing is, that's 100% true, but my God, go and try and convince people that that's the case. And it's really, really, really exhausting. It's really exhausting, and it's such a, it really makes you feel shit that people think that. And it's like, before you make that judgment, see me on stage. If you genuinely think I'm shit, then believe what you want to believe. But if I'm making people laugh and I'm progressing to the next level, you think I'm progressing because of the color of my skin or where I come from. And in actual fact, I think it's harder for people like me, because I have to turn down certain things because I can't do it. I get offered opportunities, great opportunities, but I'm like, look, I can't do that. It goes against what I believe in, or I can't do that because that's not who I am. So in actual fact, like, it's even more difficult because they expect me. Like, you know, you get people like, oh, we want you to do a set about, oh, terrorism. I'm like, what the fuck should I talk about terror? What's that got to do with me? I've never blown up shit before. Like, why do you want me to talk about it?
Oh, my God.
Maybe in a bad science class.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? Or they're like, oh, come, why don't you tell it? Tell us about, you know, like, you're, you know, how you've been, you know, oppressed growing up and how difficult. I was like, I wasn't oppressed growing up. Do I look oppressed to you, bitches? Do I look oppressed to you? They force these narratives. They think that every Muslim woman should talk about terrorism, oppression, annoying husbands.
It's really depressing that's happening.
It is.
It's really depressing that that's still happening. Like, geez, you know.
And that people have the gall and audacity to be like thinking they're offering you an opportunity to say, could you do something about like terrorism? Or like, it makes me feel so.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I'm embarrassed for them. I'm embarrassed.
It's almost like that's all they think. They think that is all it is. But then again, it always comes back to representation.
Yeah.
We as not just women, but as Muslims, as whatever, we have to make the point of saying that there is more to us than what meets the eye. And I'm not judging any comedian. You know, whatever you choose to do, you choose to do. Well done if you're succeeding. But I can't lie and say it doesn't disappoint me when certain comedians perform and do the tick box stereotype to degrade themselves to make other people laugh
more and make them more comfortable.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if I went on stage, I know for a fact, and there's other comedians that I've gigged with in the past who would, like, Muslim men that would go on stage and mock Muslim women and like make comments like, oh, I'm glad women wear burqas, that because that means none of you can see their facial hair, and oh, this and that and this and that. And wow, you've got all these white people like like laughing their heads off. And I'm like, what, you think you're a big man because you're degrading us Muslim women by making other people laugh? Like, I just don't agree with it. There is more to us, especially as women, there is more to us than just being
the Daily Mail narrative.
Exactly. And that's why I love seeing female comedians at the moment that are literally like doing stuff that is just like, you know, when you say smashing stereotypes, I'm talking smashing stereotypes. Me talking about, oh yeah, this and that and whatever is not, it's like we've all heard it and there's more to you than that. So I love seeing all these new women. You've got people like Susie Ruffle smashing it, Kerry Pritchard McLean, oh my God, amazing. Aisling B, like these are the kind of women that like I watch in comedy and I'm like, I love what they do because they're not just talking about what middle class white men want to hear.
Yeah.
I'm challenging you as a middle class white man, this is what you think of me, but actually you are wrong.
Yeah.
And teaching you and making you laugh, because laughter is the best way to get through to someone.
Yeah, it really is.
I always say laughter and food.
Show up. If I bomb, I'm going to bring loads of vegan sausage rolls and shove them down all the audience members' throats. Exactly.
Ola, so we're coming to the end of our chat, unfortunately, because we've gone all day. But just at the end of the show, we always ask our guest who a working class hero that they would like to celebrate. So who's that for you today?
Today, I want to celebrate my recent comedy writing partner. Her name is Rasha Sorbe. She's going to kill me. I'm pronouncing her name wrong. It's those foreign names. I just can't pronounce them.
Oh, God.
Barty, her name is. She's a comedy writer. And I think she saw me on TikTok. I did this thing. I did this thing for Comedy Central that went really viral on TikTok. Don't know why. But she saw it and she messaged me, and she's also working class. She's also a Muslim and she's also a woman. And I was like, oh, three boxes ticked. And she has been, and this is what I mean when people are like, oh, because you tick diversity boxes, it's easier for you. It's been so fucking hard for her. Her narratives, her this, oh, it's never been done before. Oh, we've never seen this before. No one likes to take risks. Everybody likes to do something that they know is going to work. Mm-hmm. But I have never seen anyone as hardworking, as challenging. So if, like, for example, she submits a script and they give feedback, she has zero chill and she'll be like, blah, 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 blah. She'll always have something to say. She's always fighting for the cause and fighting.
It sounds amazing.
She is so amazing. And I thought I was like, you know, it's so refreshing to see like a Muslim woman really fighting for Muslim women. It's so, so amazing. So I want to shout her out. And I'm so blessed that out of all the people she chose to work with me. And yeah, she's amazing.
And as are you. So we're going to celebrate her as well as you today.
Oh, Ola
Labib, thank you so much. It's been so, you're just so inspiring. And we're right behind you. I can't wait to sort of follow your light and see what comes next, because I know it's going to be huge. So, but thank you. Thank you today.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a really nice therapy session.
We'll be charging you in a bit.
Thanks, Ola.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Oh, what a fantastic woman. I mean, like, honestly, I know we said it at the beginning, but she must be like, she must have the record for smashing the glass ceilings here.
I know. I've been aware of her for some time now, because obviously, you know, I love my comedy, and I just love the story. I love her story, and I love that she's still working as a pharmacist. Like, I mean, that won't be for very long, will it? But she's just like, her story's so wonderful. And I love all of when she was talking about the Sudanese WhatsApp group, just so brilliant. And I just feel like she's on the verge of being huge.
It's just wonderful. I just like, you know, such a, to just be, I don't know what the right word is, just debunking so many stupid stereotypes of race, religion, gender. Just like, she's a complete kick-ass. I think she's amazing.
I know. And actually, I feel like we should book some tickets to see a show whilst we can still afford the ticket.
Yeah, right, and get them, because I don't think it'll be
exactly.
long. Be queuing for returns.
No, she's wonderful. So, yeah, I would urge you all to go and seek her out and go and see her now while you can. Oh, that's it for another week. We've got a brand new guest next week. What are you up to, Han? What's your plans this evening?
Do you know what? I am going to do absolutely nothing. Now, I do need a new TV series to get into. So if you could text me over some suggestions, that would be great.
Have you heard of a prison drama called Screw? Channel 4.
Oh, hang on a sec. Oh, I'm losing you. Anyway, oh, that's a shame.
All right, well, I'm off. I'll go and watch it on my own. Imagine just sat there watching myself on TV. Ooh, gross.
Oh, dear. I'll tell you about yourself.
We'll see you next week, guys. And remember, as always, to keep it classy. The Proper Class podcast is produced by Michelle Farr-Scott for Rangleby Productions, edited by James Torrance, with music by Tommy Music. Please don't forget to like and subscribe. Spread the word. Tell your friends, neighbours, whoever will listen. We've also got an Instagram page. Ooh, get us. And you can follow all the news and goss at The Proper Class Podcast. And if you haven't nodded off yet, we've also gone and got ourselves an official email. So do get in touch. The email is properclasspodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, folks. And remember, keep it classy.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.